Well, welcome back to part seven of our introduction to American law. My name is Richard Clem, presenting this as a continuing legal education program for attorneys, kind of a refresher of everything that you learned in law school. And also, I think this program might be appropriate for non-attorneys, just interested in learning a little bit about the American legal system and how things work. Maybe somebody toying with the idea of going to law school. Either you'll think, boy, this is great. I'm all psyched up about starting law school. Or perhaps you've listened this far and you thought to yourself, boy, this is the most boring stuff I've ever heard of. Well, you learned a valuable lesson that you don't want to be starting law school. On the other hand, if you are in that category, you've gotten through six chapters already, you may as well listen to the remaining three, because maybe something here will pique your interest. If you stumbled upon this program and you're wondering what's going on, you want more information about it, you can find that at my website, richardclem.com, where you can find information about this and other courses. But today we're going to be covering Chapter 7 in our text, pages 213 through 253, where we're talking about property law. We're talking about property. What is property? And indeed, well, you have a pretty good idea what property is. You know what I'm talking about when I say, this pencil is my property, or this house is my property. You know what I'm talking about. You know what I mean. It's kind of almost an instinctual kind of thing. But of course, when we got to law school, our law school professor probably spent several of the first weeks trying to answer the question, what is property? Because if your law school professor asked you that question on the first day of class, what is property, you'd probably be pretty hard pressed to come up with a definition that you can articulate. Although, like I say, you kind of knew instinctively what it meant all along. In fact, the author points out that even small children have an intuitive idea of what it means to be property. This toy is mine. Children very early on develop the concept of this is mine. And in other words, this particular item is my property. So there's kind of an intuitive, instinctive sense that we know what we're talking about when we say property. When we got to grade school, in our elementary school, we were learning grammar, and the teacher taught you this apostrophe S that goes after a word. And chances are he or she said something along the lines of, well, you put apostrophe S after a word to show ownership. So this is Bob's pencil, B-O-B apostrophe S. Your elementary school teacher was able to explain it in that way because you knew exactly what he or she meant when they said ownership or when they said property. You knew exactly what they meant. You had that instinctive idea of what it was. Although then we got to law school and your professor put you on the spot and asked you, what is property? And despite having learned that as a small child, despite having that reinforced when you got to elementary school, you probably were not able to articulate that definition very well. Well, who do we turn to if you want definitions of words? You, of course, turn to Blackstone, the early writer about the English common law. And Blackstone defined property as, or ownership, that is. If you own something, that means it's your property. So the ownership is the thing that you do to property. But he defined ownership, and I guess this is about as good a definition as any, as the sole and despotic dominion over things in total exclusion of any other individual in the universe. He even anticipated that aliens would try to lay claim to your piece of property, but sole and despotic dominion. So if I own this pencil, I am a total despot when it comes to it. I am a total dictator. I can say exactly what happens to this pencil because this pencil belongs to me. It is my property. I can do with it as I please. I can use it to write with. I can break it. I can throw it away. I can give it away. If I can loan it to you, I can do whatever I want with respect to that pencil because that pencil is mine. I have despotic dominion over that. I can be a despot. It is sole dominion. So I get to decide that I'm going to write with the pencil, or I get to decide that I'm going to throw away the pencil, or I get to decide that I'm going to break the pencil in two. I am the only person who gets to make that decision. You do not get to decide what happens to my pencil because I am the owner of my pencil. I have the sole and despotic dominion over that thing, in total exclusion to any other individual in the universe. It has to be a thing. We get to the next question. Well, what can be property? And the author says, well, almost any tangible thing can be property. He says almost because, for example, one lesson we learned as a country, if you would have asked somebody prior to the 13th Amendment, depending on where you were, if you asked somebody, well, can people be one of those things that you can keep as property? That fortunately has changed. So it's not anything can be property. It's almost anything. It can't be people. You get to a little bit more difficult questions, though. Because he mentions, well, what about my kidneys? Are they my property? Well, I have sole and despotic dominion over them. I have sole dominion. You can't tell me what to do with my kidneys. But on the other hand, can I sell my kidneys? The answer in this country is probably not. So if you really, really need a kidney and you have $1 million and you want to give it to me, we've chosen as a society that that's a transaction that we're not going to allow. So in that sense, in some way, my kidney is my property. But on the other hand, in some sense, it's not my property. So almost any kind of tangible thing can be property. But as the author points out, most property, most of your wealth, most of your property is probably intangible things. Your stocks and bonds, you own 1,000 shares of the Acme Widget Company. Well, that's a pretty intangible thing. I mean, indirectly, that means you own a percentage of the widget factory, but you don't actually own the widget factory. You can't go in there and exercise dominion over it. You can't just walk in and say, well, I'm one of your shareholders. I want to camp out here tonight. No, obviously you can't do that because you just own that intangible interest in the property. Other intangible, very important property are copyrights and other kinds of intellectual property. So, for example, if you I'm pretty laid back. So if I discover that somebody has bootlegged my lecture and somebody uploaded this program to YouTube, that would be a violation of my copyright. Now, I probably wouldn't stop them because I make it freely available on my website to start with. But if I wanted to, I could sue that person into bankruptcy for stealing my intangible property, namely my copyright in this program. Property, in other words, can be either tangible or intangible. The author asks the question, to what extent do we call it property if it's my right to a government privilege? So in other words, my welfare check, is that welfare check my property? Or my corporate welfare check? I have a contract with the government to produce toilet seats for $1,000 each. Is that contract? To what extent is that property? And the answer is, well, yes and no. For some purposes, it really is property. So, for example, it's property to the extent that the government can't take it away from me without due process of law. But it might not be alienable, for example. The author points out a broadcasting license for a TV or a radio station. Is that a property interest? Well, it's not transferable. I can't sell that license to somebody else, but it gives me valuable rights. So in some ways, certainly they can't take it away from me without due process of law. It's enough of property to be that, but it's not the kind of thing that is alienable. So I can't sell it. In fact, what about, speaking of the word alienable, think back of the Declaration of Independence. We remember we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And the word inalienable there means they can't be sold or transferred to anybody else. So I have the freedom of speech. I can speak what I please. But the Constitution specifically says I can't give that right away to anybody else. So that's kind of like the one thing I can't do with it. So I guess in that sense, we would say that is not a property interest, although we would certainly call it a liberty interest, I guess, which is why they had to include that. Remember, Blackstone said that we have absolute dominion, sole and despotic dominion over these things. So I own my home. Me and the bank, but I own a pretty good chunk of it. So can I exercise absolute dominion over it? Well, the answer is no, because there are a lot of things I can't do, even though it is my property. So for example, there are zoning laws. If I want to just add on to my house, I'm going to turn it into a 5-story house. Well, the zoning laws probably say that is not permitted in my neighborhood. So even though I have this despotic dominion over my little piece of land here, it's not all that despotic because I have zoning laws. I can't have a loud party. I can't because then the neighbors would call it in. I can't just leave garbage strewn on my lawn. Every once in a while, I decide, you know what, I'm going to do the environmentally responsible thing, and I'm just going to restore the natural prairie to my little piece of property here. So I put away the lawnmower and just let the nature take its course. Well, soon enough, within a few days of making that decision, I get a friendly reminder from the city. Saying that no, you have absolute dominion over your property, but you don't have absolute dominion in order to do that. So either you cut it, or we're going to send city workers over there to cut it, and it's going to be a pretty hefty bill attached to that service. Blackstone says I have despotic dominion, maybe not quite that despotic, maybe not quite that absolute. We think of the law of property as being the law of things, tangible things or intangible things. You know, you think of it as my copyright or my pencil or my house. We think of it as the law of things, but really the law of property is regulating relationships between people. What does my property right mean when I have a loud party and the neighboring property owner doesn't like it? Or when I put in a glue factory on my property and the neighboring property owners don't like it. It's a law regulating the relationships between individuals is what it really boils down to. What is property? As our old sainted law school professors would ask us. And remember, they always said something about it being a bundle of rights. So if I own this house, that means I have the absolute right to live here. or maybe not quite so absolute, but I have the right to live in it. I have the right to be here. I have the right to be present. I have the right to, build on it, to add a building. So all of these individual rights are kind of bundled together. And this large bundle of rights I have are property. Now, some of those rights would be, I have the right to exclude people. So if you come onto my property and I don't want you here, I say, you are trespassing. I have the right to exclude you. I'm going to call the cops if you don't go away. I have the right to exclude, but maybe part of that right has been taken away from me. So maybe my bundle is a little bit smaller. So for example, XL Energy wants to come onto my property to repair the cable, that's coming into it. I probably gave them an easement at some point, or my predecessors did, but there's probably an easement saying that I used to have that right to exclude you, but I gave up that right. So my bundle of rights has gotten a little bit smaller. But in general, when I say I own something, I say I have this bundle of rights, and that bundle of rights is kind of comes into four categories. I have the liberty to use the property. So I own this house, I own this pencil, I own whatever. That one of the rights in my bundle is the right to use it. If I want to build a house on my property, that's the right that I have. I have the right to use it. I have the right to use my pencil to write something. I have the right to use it. I have the right to exclude. You can't come onto my property because I don't like you. I don't need a reason other than it's my property. So I have the right to exclude you. I have the power to transfer it. If I decide I don't want this property anymore, I can give it to you or sell it to you. And then you will take over the whole bundle of rights. And I have immunity from damage. You can't come in and damage my property. If you trespass or you break my property, then I have the right to go after you for damages. Because remember, property law is really talking about the relationship between people. Okay, we talked about some of those rights: the right to use, right to exclude, right to transfer, immunity from damage, liberty to use. I think we can figure out what that means. I can do things with it, but it's not unlimited. I can't use it for a loud party. I can't use it to cause damage to your property. We'll talk about that in a minute. I have the right to exclude you. So in other words, we're talking about trespass law. That's part of the law of property, the law of trespass. I have the right to exclude you. If you don't stay excluded, then you are guilty of trespassing, and I can sue you for damages. And remember, in torts, we talked about that was an intentional tort, et cetera, et cetera. You have to intend to, you don't have to know it's my property, but you have to intend to be walking there. So I have that right to exclude you. Now, if you would have asked Blackstone, he probably would have said something about you have the right to exclude anybody from anywhere on your property in kind of a cone shape going down to the center of the earth, extending upward into the heavens infinitely. And lawyers sometimes like to say that when I own this piece of land, I own the air going up, forever. So if the moon passes over my property, I own the moon for that little period of time. That sounds good in the 1600s, but then we invented something called the airplane. I don't really have the right to exclude airplanes passing over my property at 30,000 feet. Maybe I have the right to exclude them, though, if they're flying at 100 feet. So if the if the neighbor's drone flies over is peering in my window, that's a little bit different from an airplane passing by at 30,000 feet overhead. So where exactly do I draw that? How high up does my property go? Well, I don't know. It still extends all the way into the heavens, but there are exceptions that have been built up over the years, such as that airplane at 30,000 feet. I can't sue them for trespassing. Also, a lot of people, that airplane, one way of looking at it is that airplane has a license. The airplane has permission to come into my property. And there are other ways that I can give permission for you to come into my property, either expressly or impliedly. I can say, please come to my door. But on the other hand, I also have a sidewalk leading up to my doorbell. And, why do you have a doorbell there other than occasionally strangers will come and ring it? So impliedly, you have a license to walk up as far as my doorbell and ring the doorbell. There are licenses there. Some are implied or created as a result of some other law. So, for example, if I own a business, in general, I can say, get out of my business. I don't want you here. It's my property. But if my motive for doing that is because I want to discriminate against you because of your race, well, no, that's not the case. And in that sense, you have a license to enter my property because, yes, I have a right to exclude trespassers, but I don't have the right to discriminate based upon people's race. Trespassing is another way of saying that I have the right to exclude people from my property. A closely related concept to that is the concept of nuisance. Trespass talks about you physically entering in my property, you walking in. What if you don't enter in by walking in or flying over in an airplane or something, you cause problems to me on my property, on the place where I have despotic dominion. You cause problems to that because of smoke or vibrations or something like that. So if you interfere with my use of my property unreasonably, with your smoke or your vibrations or your noise or something like that, then you're guilty of nuisance, and I can sue you for damages or to have that put to an end. Where do you draw the line, though? Reasonableness. The author uses the example of your neighbor's kid is practicing the piano badly for an hour after school every day. Well, maybe that's reasonable, but if they're practicing their trombone at 3 a.m. out in the driveway, well, maybe that's not reasonable. Like I say, that's kind of a close cousin to trespass, the doctrine of nuisance, because what you're doing in the case of trespass, actually coming onto my property, or something that you're doing nearby that's causing unpleasantness to me would be a nuisance. In either one of those, I might have a remedy in court. Remember, again, when we're talking about all these things, what is property? Well, property law is really a regulation of relationships. The relationship between me and you coming onto my property is either a trespasser or a licensee or whatever. Again, property law is really not regulating things. It's regulating relationships between people. Well, then the author asks the question, why do we need property law? And he comes up with some rationales for it. In North Korea, you don't need property law. The children in North Korea probably have this innate concept of, this toy is mine. When they grow up, they don't have property anymore. They do what they're told. So they don't need property law in North Korea, but in our society we do. And one of the main reasons why we have it, or the goals of property law, is to encourage productive activity. So we want everybody to be productive and be protected when they are being productive. If I spend all my time growing a crop and then, the day before I harvest it, you come in and trespass and steal my crop, well, I don't have much incentive to be productive. But I do have, I get that incentive back because I know if you do that, I can have you arrested for stealing because it was my property that you stole. So it encourages productive activity. If you can use my property more efficiently than I do, well, then you have an incentive to buy it from me, and I have an incentive to sell it to you. And that's the what lawyers sometimes call the highest and best use. Property is always trying to find its highest and best use, and property law should encourage productivity. In other words, it should encourage the highest and best use of all of our property. So encouraging productivity is an important part of property law, but also it's a protection of personal liberty the government does not have despotic dominion over us, or at least it's not supposed to. How do we ensure that? Well, because I am the one who has despotic dominion over my things, to the exclusion of all others. So the fact that we have private property really does protect our political liberty. I can speak freely as long as I have a little piece of property on which I can do my free speech. So I can, I have a lawn, so I can put out a lawn sign saying vote for so-and-so. And as long as I have a lawn, I'm able to speak that way. Personal property protects political liberty. The author says, I'm not sure exactly what this means, but it contributes to human flourishing. Life is just better if we have things. Maybe not necessarily, once you get to a certain point, you can have too many things. But there's a certain point even that North Korean child instinctively says, this toy is mine. We need a system that encourages that innate human characteristic, that kind of instinctive idea that some of these things are mine. That's part of what it means to be a human, to have dominion over some things. So it contributes to human flourishing in that sense. So that's why we have property law. It encourages productive activity, but also protects political liberty, and also just generally protects flourishing of the human condition. At this time, we're going to give our first code number for this portion of the program. Driving, don't stop to write it down, but write this down. And our first code number for this portion of the program is 7-134. 7-134. 7-134 is our first code number for this portion of the program. What kinds of property are there? And if you're following along in the text, we're up to about page 220 right now. What are the different kinds of property? And here the author reminds us that in general, all kinds of property in the world are broken down into two categories, real property and personal property. And what is real property? Real property is land and things that are permanently attached to the land. So a piece of land, there's a house built on the land. Well, the house is real property. Things that are nailed to the walls of that house, they're permanently attached to the property. What about the light bulbs? The light bulbs, maybe they're personal property, maybe they're real property. So if you, although if you sold a house to somebody and they get there and all the light bulbs have been unscrewed, they would probably argue that they were part of the real property. So there it gets kind of kind of iffy, but in general, the definition of real property is things that are permanently attached, and personal property is everything else. So in other words, things that are not land or nailed down to land. Those are the two categories. The reason why there are two categories is because the law of real property has quite a few more formalized procedures that might be absent in the world of personal property, but in general, the same general principles apply. Those are the two categories of property. And of course, there's tangible property. There's things. There are pencils and houses and land and cars and things like that, tangible things. And then there are intangible things. There are stocks, bonds. There's intellectual property. There's copyright. So you are not allowed to, make a bootleg copy of today's lecture and, sell it on the black market and make millions. Because that is my intellectual property. I'm the only one who has the right to do that. And patents and inventions, another form of it. He gives one kind of extreme example is Amazon's patent for the one-click system. They invented that. Somebody else, said, to buy things on the internet, I think we should click 5 times. And somebody said, I think we should click 10 times. And then Amazon came along and said, hey, to buy something, you can click 1 time. And that's such a novel idea that we're going to patent it. So inventions and patents are property. Maybe some microbes. If you create a new living thing, by genetic engineering or whatever, well, that's probably patentable. So the right to copy that microbe is your property. What are those things? A patent is an invention, a way of a process, a way of doing something. A copyright is an expression of an idea. I can't copyright the concept of American law, but I can copyright my words that I'm using to talk to you about it today. Trademark is the origin of an item. So I have the right to the name. If you came to richardclem.com and somebody else decided to come up with richardclem.com spelled with a K they're doing CLEs also trading off my good name, well, I could probably put a stop to that. On the other hand, if I decide to change the name of my business from richardclem.com to West Legal Ed Center, well, I probably wouldn't be able to get away with that because somebody else owns that trademark. If a program says West Legal Ed Center, that means it originated with the people at Thomson Reuters who own that trademark. When you came to a CLE that said, Richard Clem Continuing Legal Education, you can rest assured that it was a genuine CLE originating from Richard Clem. On all of these things, keep in mind, not just in these intangible things, but in the tangible things, what gives the property right? The law gives the property right. And that's easy to see in the case of a patent or a copyright or a trademark or something. But also for tangible things. Property does not just spring into being with an owner. The law has to assign at some point who the owner is. It might be very direct, like you get a patent of land because you're a homesteader, farming your 40 acres out on the frontier, and the government gives you a piece of paper saying you now own this property. There it's very clear that it's by operation of law. But in general, just the general principles of law. You know, when you paid me 25 cents and I handed you a pencil, that pencil became your property. But it's not your property because it's a pencil. It's because it's your property because there's a law that says in these circumstances, you are the owner of the property. So, you know, so if I, maybe I manufacture a piece of property, you know, I build a better mousetrap, you know, and I'm working on it. Well, just the fact that I manufactured it does not make it my property because I might be working in your mousetrap factory. And it's your property, even though I'm the one manufacturing it. So the law is the thing that creates the property right, was kind of an important concept. Is everything property? Well, are all things property of somebody? Well, no, because there is the concept of the public domain, which is easy to see. For example, at my blog, onetuberadio.com, if you want to check that out. A lot of times I have a lot of interesting historical things. And sometimes, for example, I will use a picture from a book that's 100 years old. You know, so I say on this day in history, 100 years ago, this thing happened, and here's a picture of it. And somebody took that picture 100 years ago. Well, I can do that. I don't have to worry about that photographer coming to sue me because the law says that after a certain period of time, the copyright ceases to exist and it goes into the public domain. In other words, the right to copy that particular picture is not anybody's property anymore. It's in the public domain. And it's less common, but intangible objects might be in the public domain as well. So for example, if I go to a lake and go out in the lake and find an interesting looking rock, well, who does that rock belong to? Well, it doesn't belong to anybody. It's in the public domain. So unless there's some law that says you can't take rocks home from the lake, if I take that rock out of the lake and bring it home, I don't have to worry about somebody suing me for stealing it from them because it's nobody's property. Now, at a certain point, it might become my property, but as it is, it is not the property of anybody. It is in the public domain. The law, one thing the author points out is that the law oftentimes is always in the process of balancing conflicting rights. And as an example of that, he gives the fair use doctrine from copyright law. On my blog, some of the pictures are over 100 years old. That I put in there, and they're in the public domain. I don't have to worry about it. But occasionally, I will I'll be looking at some interesting magazine or newspaper article from 50 years ago, and I will maybe use a little piece of that picture and copy it, even though somebody else owns the copyright. Well, I'm probably okay because the law says that even though that person has an absolute right, a despotic right over their copyright, well, there are limitations. And if I make fair use of it, if I just use a little bit of it and, properly source it and so forth, then it's probably okay. But the law defines what property rights are, and the law is continually balancing conflicting rights. Well, now here the author jumps in and asks the question kind of out of the blue, but had to work it in somewhere. And we didn't talk about this when I was in law school because we didn't have it. He asks the question, who owns the internet? And talks about some of these internet related properties. So who owns the internet? He says, well, the easy question is there's a lot of physical infrastructure and everybody owns, every piece of physical infrastructure or almost all of it is owned by somebody. So the router in my house is owned either by me or maybe by the cable company. The cable running from inside my house is my property. The cable outside the house probably belongs to Comcast or somebody. You know, there are different, there are, you know, data centers out in, you know, in Utah or someplace, you know, they belong to somebody. That physical infrastructure, that's an easy case. That, you know, that's pretty easy to figure it out. The other thing, the information on the internet, that belongs to somebody. For the most part, all information that you see belongs to somebody, either either in a trademark sense or a copyright sense. So, you know, the name Google.com, well, that's a pretty valuable trademark of the Google people. Content on the internet is certainly subject to copyright. So somebody owns the copyright. If this recording that you're listening to is owned by Richard Klemm, you know, I have the right to distribute that to you and play it to you and to exclude you. I can say I don't want you listening to my program. I'm gonna shut it down, or I'm not gonna allow you to copy it. So I have the ownership over that information. But again, there's that concept of fair use. On my website, you'll see pictures that I don't have the copyright to, but it's probably okay because it's probably fair use. And the author points out that, interestingly, that if it's, if there's some kind of transformation involved, then it's probably fair use because we're making that asset more valuable, really. So for example, if you go to Google and you do a Google search for something, you know, do a Google image search for something, well, you'll see a lot of copyrighted images. And Google is making a copy of some image and presenting it to you. You know, that image belongs to somebody else, but it's right there in the search results. Well, that's okay. That's fair use because they're actually making that property more valuable. By doing that kind of transformation, not just taking this picture that's out there somewhere, but instead transforming it into part of a useful list of search results. Hopefully, you know, my website, you know, if I use some copyrighted picture from 1950 that's still under copyright, but I just use a small piece of it, and I add value to that. I transform it by talking about it and making it known to people, making people be able to find it. Hopefully that is a fair use as well. The author talks a little bit about something we obviously didn't have to worry about when I was in law school, cyber squatting. There are laws against cyber squatting. I'm guessing that Google probably thought about this and they probably reserved all the names, but let's say that I realized that the domain name Google.com, G-O-G-O-O-G-A-L, Google, Google.com, that's not been taken. So I seize upon that, I register it, and I put in kind of a not very good search engine on Google.com. Well, the Google people probably aren't going to like that too well because they will say that I'm cyber squatting, that I'm taking advantage of their domain name. I guess that's not exactly cyber squatting. That's more of a trademark violation. What cyber squatting would be is, you know, you own the Acme widget company and you're not too cyber savvy. You're not too internet savvy. You don't have a website yet at the Acme widget company. So I go for, you know, $4.95 and I register, you know, acmewidget.com. And I put, you know, I don't even bother using it. Well, the cyber squatting laws say that I can probably be forced to turn that over to you because I have no good reason for that. And one of the examples they've given, have you ever heard of electronicsboutique.com? I never heard of them, but apparently it was big at some point, or they thought it was big. Electronicsboutique.com. Or I forget which was the original, which was the copy. But one of them was electronicsboutique.com that was hopefully going to be successful. Well, somebody else came along and registered the name electronicboutique.com, without the S, without the plural. The case cited in the book says that you can't do that because that is kind of like cyber squatting or trademark infringement. On the other hand, if I want to do something transformative, I don't like Bally Fitness, so I come up with a website that's called ballysucks.com. Well, that's okay because that it's transformative. I'm not just taking your name and pretending to be you. I'm talking about you. I'm saying bad things about you probably. But the ballysucks.com case says that that is permissible because I'm not passing myself off as you, so it's not a trademark violation. The traditional trademark law or copyright law could have rendered the internet kind of useless because what if I post some copyrighted material on YouTube or in the Google search results or on Facebook or something? Does Facebook have to be running around policing that all the time? Because they're the publisher, they're acting in concert with me to publish this pirated copyrighted material. To the rescue, we have the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is doesn't really change the substantive law too much, but it kind of sets up a procedure insulating those players like Google and YouTube and Facebook, insulating them by saying that there is a very specific remedy. If my copyrighted material appears on YouTube, for example. So somebody records today's lecture and they post a pirated copy on YouTube. Well, I can't just go sue YouTube into bankruptcy because the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says I have to go through a certain procedure. And what that procedure is I have to inform them and I have to give them a certain amount of time to take it down. So before I commence a lawsuit against them, I have to say, hey, YouTube, please take this down because I am the owner of this copyrighted material. And then if they comply with that in a certain period of time, then they're kind of insulated from liability. What we did learn back in law school, probably in torts class, but also in property law, is the concept of trespass to chattels. You remember that tort of trespass to chattels? So you're not just trespassing on my land, but you're stealing my car. You take my car for a joyride, and maybe you didn't even cause any damage or anything, but you committed a trespass to chattels because it's not your car, it's my car. I have the right to exclude you from it. So I could sue you for trespass to chattels. We have similar concepts in cyberspace. So for example, if I do kind of a denial of service attack against your website, I'm probably trespassing to your chattels. The law has expanded that a little bit. Another internet regulation that they talk about is the CAN Spam Act, that you can't spam people. You can't send all kinds of unsolicited commercial email. And if you do, there's a specific remedy. Now, has that law actually worked very well? No, well, maybe not, because it's kind of hard to track down the people. And also, as we talked about in our contract law lecture, there are a lot of contract law issues that have arisen with the internet, like that I accept button. What happens when you click the I accept button? Does that mean you've entered into a contract? So the author kind of took this little segue here to talk about the some of the internet property issues. We'll get back into our classical property law here in a second. But first, we'll give you our second code number for this portion of the program. Our second code number for this hour of the program is 7-238. 7-238. 7-238 is our next code number for this portion of the program. Well, we now return to the property law that we learned in law school under the tutelage of Blackstone or whoever was our property professor. And we get to the question of, well, how do you acquire property? How does property become yours? Because we already said that property doesn't become property just by virtue of existing. The law has to confer that ownership interest upon you. So that's what we talk about here. How do we acquire property? If you're following along in the text, we're on page 226. Well, the most common way that that you think to do it is, do you buy it? I go into, the grocery store and buy a gallon of milk, and I put the money there and they give me the milk. That milk is now my property, because I bought it. So that's probably the most common one. One we don't have very much anymore is you can acquire property by discovery and conquest. So if you're sailing from your English harbor, sailing to some other place, and you discover a new piece of land. It's easier if it's uninhabited, but even if it's inhabited, we'll just kind of ignore those inhabitants for now, maybe. But you discover this new land, and you conquer it. You conquested it. Now, you remember in law school, the examples we always had, you were talking about transferring property, and the people in these hypotheticals were always named O and A, and sometimes B came along. So you would have this discussion in class about, O transfers the property to A. And did he transfer it in fee simple, absolute, or whatever? But we ask the question, you learn that for a while. And we talk about O transfers the property to A, and then later on A transfers the property to B, and later on B transfers the property to C. But we always start out with O. So finally, one of the students will raise their hand and say, "Well, where did O get it?" O got it probably from discovery and conquest. That's how O got it in the first place. And the law of discovery and conquest, we don't have that much anymore, is first in time, first in right. We don't worry about that too much, but in some senses we do, if you go fishing, well, those fish down there are probably in the public domain. They're, if anything, maybe they're property of the state. So you go fishing and you catch a fish. Well, that fish becomes your property. And that's really like discovery and conquest. And the rule behind discovery and conquest is first in time, first in right. So whoever lands first on the land and conquests it, somehow showing ownership, like planting the flag. That means that you are the owner because you were first in time, first in right under the law of discovery and conquest. Found a property. You can acquire property by finding it. I'm walking down the street minding my own business and I see $100 bill on the ground. I found it. So it's mine, right? Well, yeah, it kind of is mine because I found it. Now, here the exception is on found property, I have rights superior to that property to everybody in the world. Remember, I have that absolute dominion over not the whole world. Remember, Blackstone said everyone in the universe. I have absolute dominion over that $100 bill against everyone in the universe, with one exception, and that is the person who lost it, also known as the true owner. So that if that true owner ever comes along and says, "Hey, that's my $100 bill I lost," I have to give it back to them. They give the example of somebody finds this valuable ring. So they take it to a jeweler and say, "Hey, look, I found this ring. Is it worth anything?" And I found it. It was laying on the ground. And the jeweler looks at it and says, this is worth millions. I'm not giving it back to you, by the way, because you don't own it. You just said you found it. Well, I own it more than you do. So I have absolute dominion over that property against the whole universe, with the exception of the person who lost it, the true owner. How do we acquire property? Buy it, you can find it, or you can acquire it by adverse possession. Now, adverse possession, you know, some that gets some people's blood pressure up when you start talking about that, because it sounds like, well, it's a legal way to steal property. So I am, you know, I find this abandoned, farm somewhere, and I move in. I just start living there. And after a certain period of time, varying from state, traditionally 21 years, maybe as little as 10 years, if I possess it for that period of time, well, it's mine. It has to be continuous. It has to be open and notorious. I can't just secretly kind of creep in and not tell anybody that I'm there. But if I'm notorious about it, you know, I'm rewarded for trespassing. Well, why do we have that law? Well, it's similar to a statute of limitations, really, because if you owe me $20, and I just forget about it, you know. So in 1979, you loaned me $20, and everybody kind of forgot about it. Then and now, you know, 40 years later, you come along and say, "Hey, where's that $20 you owe me?" And I say, "Well, I've forgotten all about that. And that's barred by the statute of limitations." It's the same kind of thing here. That if I trespass on your property for 20 years, well, then, or 21 years, then 21 years is the statute of limitations. You can't sue me for trespassing anymore. And if you can't sue me for trespassing, that really means, well, I own it. I can sue you for trespassing. So adverse possession, when you think of it that way, it's not quite as immoral as you think it would. It's no more immoral than that statute of limitations for, you know, you crashed into my car 20 years ago, so I'm going to sue you. You say, well, that's just too old. So you can acquire property by adverse possession. You can acquire property by gift. Now the law, you remember a contract. When I said, I promise I'll give you $1 million tomorrow. Well, that's not enforceable because there was no consideration. It was a gift, a promise of a gift. But if I actually give you the money and you take it, I can't come back and say, you know what, I changed my mind. I want that gift back. So once a gift is made, not a promise of a gift, but an actual gift, then that is a way that you can acquire property. For there to be a gift, I have to intend to make a gift. So in the back, I can't just, I didn't just accidentally drop it in front of you or something. I was intending to give it to you as a gift. I had to deliver it to you and you had to accept it. So as long as those three elements are met, then you now own the property as a gift. Okay, we're going to go into a little bit more detail now. Those are the different ways you can acquire property. And the first one, you say, well, you buy it. So we're going to talk a little bit more detail about that. And here, we're going to go into a little bit more detail specifically about real property. Because, again, there's more formality associated with real property, with land. So the example the author gives is you're buying a house. Well, so if I buy a gallon of milk at the store, probably a lot less formality. But if I'm buying a piece of land, there's a lot more formality that's required. There has to be a contract. So there has to be an offer and acceptance. Now, when exactly is it, you know, who made the offer and who accepted it? Well, sometimes you can't really pin that down. It's not necessary to pin it down, but just collectively, yeah, there was an agreement to sell the property here. In the case of property, if I buy a gallon of milk at the store, they'll give me a little cash register receipt. But that cash register receipt doesn't really have too much legal standing. It's kind of just evidence of the fact that I gave them the money. So if you know, the police officer comes and say, "Hey, you shoplifted that milk." I say, "Oh, no, I didn't. I paid for it. Here's my receipt." But that receipt is not really necessary. But in the case of a sale of land, there is a piece of paper called a deed. And the deed is just a formal document that embodies the conveyance. So there is no transfer of real property without this formal document called a deed. But there has to be a deed. Oh, well, is there always had to be a deed? Well, no, a deed is a relatively new development. Because recent, like in the last 200 years, probably. But before we had deeds, and back maybe when people were not quite as literate, we had something else. So a deed is really a replacement for that something else, which was called the livery of season. And a livery of season was not a document, but kind of a formal ritual. So that everybody knew that, hey, the property was sold today. You'd have a little ceremony out on the land, and the seller would literally hand over a little clump of dirt or a few sticks off the ground, and say, I am selling you this land. Here's one lump of the dirt, and plus you own all the rest of it too. And then people would be gathered around. They would see that, and if there was ever any question about who owned this piece of property, say, well, it's the new guy because we all came to see this little ceremony when he bought it a couple of years ago. It was kind of a memorable kind of thing. But instead of doing that, now we have deeds. We have a piece of paper, and that piece of paper is recorded down at the county recorder's office. So I don't have to go ask the neighbors, did you see the livery of season for this property? Instead, I go down to the county recorder's office, or I do it online. Say who owns lot 7, block 22 of this development, and I can look up the name of who owns it, because there is a formal document, a deed, with the new person's name on it. Title is just another word for ownership. Title is the concept of ownership. So when we say that you acquired title to this property, you're just saying that you got the ownership of the property. We talked about recording. The deeds are recorded, there are laws that will vary a little bit from state to state, but basically say that if I'm dishonest and I sell my property twice, well, the second guy, you really can't complain about it too much, because you should have gone down to the county recorder's office and made sure that I was properly selling it to you. So that's why we have recording, to make sure that we know who owns property at any given time, and to prevent frauds. The way you prevent fraud is, before you hand over the money for the property, you better go down to the county recorder's office and make sure that the person you're giving the money to really owns it. So that's why we have recording laws. The stuff down at the county recorder's office might include a lot of liens. And what a lien is... Remember, I own the property. I own the whole bundle of rights. But a lien is, well, somebody else has one little right. Or they might have an easement. So XL Energy has an easement to come onto my property to fix the lines. The mortgage, the biggest lien might be the mortgage, also known as a deed of trust. They own the right to take my property away if I don't pay for it. So that's a pretty big thing in that bundle of rights. And at this time, we're going to give you our third code number for this part of the program, which is 7-392. 7-392. 7-392 is our next code number. What happens when you die? Is what we talk about next. We're going to touch on the whole, the law of probate and so forth. As my property professor in law school, the one Latin phrase they learned the one Latin phrase I learned was nemo est hare viventis. That the living have no heirs, because you become an heir when somebody dies. But the other thing we learned in law school is if you're dead, you can't own property. That one of the absolute requirements. Remember, you have to exercise dominion over the property. You can't exercise dominion once you're dead. So once you're dead, you don't own property anymore. But what happens to it? Well, we have a special court called the probate court. And the probate court has jurisdiction over the issue of who gets your property after you die. And how they do that, and we're going to give you a kind of a two-minute lesson here in probate law, so you probably won't become experts in it. But the probate court names somebody called an executor or administrator, or here in Minnesota, that person is called the personal representative. And that person distributes the property. It says, okay, the car goes here, and the boat goes here, and the house goes here, and the bank account goes here. That person distributes the property under the control of the probate court that has jurisdiction. That distribution can be in one of two ways. It can be a testate case, or it can be an intestate case. And testate simply means that you have a will. And a will is a document saying where you want your property to go after you die. We'll talk about it a little bit more in a minute. So that would be testate succession. In a testate case, the executor, or in Minnesota called the personal representative, would say, okay, the will here, paragraph one, says that this person gets the bank account. So here's the bank account. And this person gets the property. That person, the personal representative, just administers the will. In an intestate case, then you look to the intestate succession laws of the state instead of looking at a will. And in that case, the intestate succession laws generally say that first the surviving spouse gets the property, and if there's no surviving spouse, then it goes to the children. And then if there are no children, it goes to the children's children. And it has that all laid out. And it'll vary a little bit from state to state. But those first two examples are pretty much the same everywhere. The surviving spouse, if any, gets the property, and then the children get the property. If there is no will. But if there is a will, then, well, pretty much anything goes. Whatever the will says, that's how the property is going to be distributed. With one exception is that even in the case of a will, the spouse gets an elective share. So if the person is married and they have a will, then they say, I don't want my spouse to get anything. I'm going to cut off. I don't like my spouse, so I'm going to give all my property to the Humane Society. The spouse can elect to say, yeah, that sounds good to me. I don't want the money. Or the spouse can say, I've decided to, instead of following the will, I'm going to take my elective share, which is probably about half of the estate. So anyway, the spouse has an elective share. But other than that, you can do pretty much whatever you want in a will. Wills have to be signed, in most states, have to be signed by two witnesses. And they're very formal requirements. So the will has to be in writing. It has to be signed at the bottom. I mean, if the person can't read and write, well, it can be signed maybe with an X. But also, most states require that a will be signed by two witnesses who sign and say, yes, I was here at the time that he was signing this will. He said it was his will. And I'm signing for that. In Minnesota, pretty much any will has to have two witnesses. Some states, but not Minnesota, allow a holographic will. No, that's not like a hologram, but it's a will that's written. Basically, it's a special rule that says two witnesses are not required if the entire will is in the person's own handwriting. So if that person prints off the will off their computer and then signs it at the bottom, well, that's not a holographic will. It has to be in their own handwriting. And if it's in their own handwriting, then the courts will dispense with that two witness requirement. But like I say, Minnesota does not do that. I believe Wisconsin does have holographic wells, but not Minnesota. So in Minnesota, no matter, you know, it's perfectly fine if you want to do a handwritten will, but it still has to be signed by two witnesses. And one example they gave, why do you have this rule? I guess it was for this case where this farmer was injured in an agricultural accident, and he realized he was a goner, so he said he found something, and I don't know if it was a marker or just a rock or something, but he scratched into the side of his tractor. If I don't make it, I want my property to be distributed this way. Well, that was a valid holographic will in that state because it was in his own handwriting. And there was not a need for two witnesses in that case, because if there had been two witnesses, you would think they would try to get him out of his predicament rather than witnessing his will. So that's presumably why some states have that requirement for holographic will. But in general, wills have to be signed by two witnesses. Now, if in Minnesota, you always want to do a self-proved affidavit. So you get two witnesses plus a notary. And that makes things a lot easier when you get to probate court, if you have two witnesses plus a notary and follow the exact self-proved affidavit language. Although that's not strictly necessary, but as long as you have two witnesses, you might have a little bit more work to do when you get to court. In Minnesota, you always want to do that self-proved affidavit, unless, you know, in some situation where you just no way to come up with a notary. Well, then I guess you just do it with the two witnesses, and then you figure out exactly how you proceed when you get to court. Wills have to be signed by the testator and signed by two witnesses. And they have to be in writing. And the testator, I used that word there, didn't I? Testator. That testator just means somebody who's writing a will. The testator, the person writing a will, has to have mental capacity. And they have to understand what they're doing. They have to understand that, yes, this is a will. This is going to say where my property goes after I die. They don't need to make wise decisions or anything. You know, the judge is not going to look at it and say, "Boy, this guy just sure made a crazy decision with his property." You don't really need that kind of capacity. You just need to know what you're doing. And there can't be any undue influence. The court will look very skeptically if you give your entire $1 million estate to the nurse who is caring for you. Because there was going to be an argument, say, boy, that person just used undue influence. In my ethics program, you know, we always talk about as an attorney, don't draft a will naming yourself as a beneficiary, because you'll get into trouble there, and there's just kind of a black and white rule. But even if you are not the attorney drafting it, if a client gives a lot of money to their lawyer in their will, even if some other lawyer was involved, well, a court is going to look pretty strongly at that to make sure that there was no undue influence. The program just talks, or the text just talks briefly about the concept of a trust. And a trust just means that you are holding property, but you're doing it for the benefit of another. I am the trustee of this trust, because it was set up by somebody wanting to transfer the money to their children, but they wanted it transferred to their children slowly. So I as the trustee, I have the checkbook, and I write checks to the children once a month, rather than just handing them over, here's the $1 million. So a trust just means I am holding property for the benefit of another. That's what a trust is. Can you own property collectively? And the answer is yes, you can. And the text talks about it on page 239. There are three ways, really, to hold property collectively. In other words, more than one person owns a piece of property. You can own it as joint tenancy with right of survivorship, or tenancy in common. And so when two people are buying property together, or it comes into their hands together, you have to specify on the deed, is this joint tenancy or is this tenancy in common? The default is if nothing is specified, then it's tenancy in common. Well, what's the difference? If you hold property as joint tenants with another person, that means that you have the right of survivorship. In other words, when one of those two people dies, then the other person owns it 100%. The other way of doing that, you and I own this property 50-50 together as tenants in common. That means that when one of us dies, the survivor still owns 50%. And then that other 50%, that just goes to whoever it would go to on death, through your will or through your relatives or whatever. So those are the two ways of holding property together with another person. Kind of a special case of joint tenancy is called tenancy by the entireties. That just means in the case of a married couple. It's kind of automatically the right of survivorship. And that's why it's called tenancy by the entirety rather than just joint tenancy. But those are really the two ways, joint tenancy, comma, and tenancy by the entirety. And the other way is tenancy in common. And the default is tenancy in common. What do you own if you own property together with somebody else? Well, generally it's called an undivided interest. So you own, you have the right to use your property whenever you feel like it. And you have all the rights associated with property, and except the right to exclude, you can exclude everybody except your co-owner. So if you own a house as tenants in common with another person, you can kick anybody else out of the house that you want to, but you can't kick that person out because you have the right to exclude anybody except that person. What about divorce? What happens to property in divorce? Because divorce is kind of a specialized branch of the law of property because it's decided like kind of like probate court is. Probate court decides what do we do with property after somebody dies. The divorce court has jurisdiction over distribution of property in the case of divorce. So this couple, this married couple, they just can't stand each other anymore. They want to get a divorce. What do we do with the property? Well, the divorce court decides that by doing what's called equitable distribution. They owned all this property as part of their marital property. Maybe they owned the house as tenants by the entirety, but they're not married anymore. So the court has to equitably decide how to divide that up. And general property that was earned during the marriage is the property of the marriage. So if a couple went into marriage owning nothing and they get divorced, well, chances are the court is probably going to split that property up 50-50 because that property belongs to both of them jointly. On the other hand, in general, if somebody came into the marriage with property, the one spouse had $1 million before the marriage, and they get married, and then after the marriage, they divide up all the property, and it's worth $1.1 million. Well, chances are that $1 million belongs to the spouse who had it originally, and then the increase in value is divided up between the two of them equitably. And of course, what does equitable distribution mean? That's, way beyond the scope of this program. And I just grossly oversimplified things right there. But that's generally what a divorce court is doing. A divorce court is kind of a specialized property court that deals with the equitable distribution of spouses who are getting divorced. There are other ways to share ownership. So we talked about, me and you owning this property together. But there are other ways to share ownership. And in general, we think of those as being called servitudes. So I own the property, but in servitude to you. So the most common one, for example, would be an easement. So yes, I own this house, but I'm in servitude to XL Energy because XL Energy has the right to come in to fix their lines because they have an easement. Another kind of servitude might be a license. So you are permitted to come onto my property in a little less formal fashion, kind of like an easement. There might be covenants. There might be, the homeowners association. When I bought this property, I had to join the homeowners association, and there's a covenant that says I will have the homeowners association approve the color of paint that I use on my house. Well, I am in servitude to them because they have that covenant. And then there are also things like life estates. You can divide up property temporally. So I can sell a piece of property to you to live during your lifetime because I want to make sure you have a place to live. So I convey this property to you for the rest of your life. And normally, when you buy property, you buy it, you get to say where it goes after your death. You can put it in your will. But here, your interest in the property terminates along with you. So a life estate is a kind of servitude in the property. This point, we have another 5 or 10 minutes to go, but we're going to give you our one more code number for the program, and that is 7-487. 7-487. 7-487 is our next code number for this part of the program before we turn to the subject of landlord-tenant law. Traditionally, when you thought of landlord-tenant law, we were thinking of property law. Over time, though, it's really evolved more into it's kind of a specialized aspect of contract law. Because it used to be we would think of a lease as kind of an interest in real property, as a servitude. And we would look at that, kind of like that life estate or kind of like that easement, that, this lease gives you a certain right to do things on the property. If you're renting an apartment for 1 year, well, maybe that doesn't work too well. Maybe it's better just to think of it in terms of being a contract. It's a specialized kind of contract, a lease property. And the main thing to remember, but, traditionally it has its roots in property law, but now, you look at it pretty much like you would any other contract. But with the understanding that an important part of that contract is something called the warranty of habitability. So if I rent an apartment in this 3-story apartment building and, the building burns down, I probably don't have to pay my rent anymore because part of this contract was you warranted. You promised that it would stay habitable for the time I lived in there. So that warranty of habitability is a part of every lease agreement pretty much. So that's landlord-tenant law. In the 2-minute version. Takings of property, kind of a hot button issue. Can the government take your property away from you? That doesn't sound too good, but sometimes the government has to take your property away from you. Because if the government wants to do some legitimate government activity, such as build a road, well, they need... they need a place to put that road, or if they want to build a park, or if they want to build a post office. And, the government wants to engage in some of these activities. Now, especially the case of the road is really an easy way, is a lot easier than some of these other things to justify eminent domain. I gave you a new word there, eminent domain, the taking of property by the government. A road is a very compelling case to say that the government needs to take property from you to build this road. Because if you're going to build a road from point A to point B, well, what's the fastest way to get from point A to point B? Well, a straight line. There's kind of a compelling interest for the state to say, look, we're going to build a road. We want the best possible road, and we want our road to be straight. And I'm sorry, that straight line happens to go through your property. If the government wants to build a new post office, Well, that's a legitimate government interest, but in my mind, that's a little bit less compelling for taking of property, because they'll come along and say, we want to build a post office. And the best possible place we've decided for the post office is your property. So we're going to take your property away from you and put a post office there. Well, you can pretty easily say in that case, well, wait a minute, post office, why don't you just build it next door to my house? You know, what difference does it really make exactly where the post office is? Whereas the road or the drainage ditch or something, you're kind of stuck. You know, I mean, the laws of physics say that it has to go in this certain place. So those are a little bit more compelling case for the government taking your property. Now, where does it say in the Constitution that the government can take your property? And the answer is it doesn't. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say the government can take your property. What the Constitution does say is that if the government does take your property, they have to give just compensation. So yes, the government can take your property away from you, but they have to pay you for it. They have to pay you the fair amount that it's worth. But that's in the Fifth Amendment. It says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. But notice it doesn't say the government may take your property under certain situations as long as they pay for it. It's a limitation on what everybody understood to be one of the inherent powers of government. Because the Constitution does not say that the state has the power of eminent domain. That's a presupposed that, yeah, they have that, just like they have the right to arrest criminals and put them in jail. That's an inherent power of government. but there's a limitation. And the limitation is that if the government does take your property, they have to pay just compensation. Now, but when can they take it? Well, again, the Constitution doesn't say. The Constitution just says that they have to pay for it. But it does say that nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. So that kind of implies that inherent right that the state has to take your power, that's not just to do willy-nilly, that's only to do for public use. And so clearly, if I'm building a road between point A and point B, that road is going to be open to the public. I am taking that road for public use. And it's very compelling because we want it to be a straight road. We don't want it to have to curve around your house because you refuse to sell. So that's a pretty clear case of public use. The post office is a pretty clear case of public use because the public is going to use that post office. And I suppose you could argue, you know, why didn't you build it a block away? But still, it's still a public use, or a public park, or, you know, some other public use. What if my public use, though, is, you know, we don't like how you're using your land. You know, you have your little house there, and that's fine with you. But we have an idea for a public use. And our public use is we're going to take your land, we'll give you just compensation for it, and we're going to kick you out of your house, we're going to pay you, send you on your way, not worry about you after that, and then we're going to bulldoze your house, and then we're going to sell the land to Walmart to put in a new Walmart where your house used to be. Well, in my opinion, that is not a public use. They're taking it for private use. And that inherent power that the state has to take property away from citizens, in my opinion, is limited to cases like roads or maybe post offices or maybe parks where there is a compelling state interest for doing that. And one of those interests is not just, pleasing the powers that be, thinking that your land would be a lot nicer for everybody with a Walmart there as opposed to your house. So that's obviously kind of a hot button issue. That came up in the case of Kelo versus the City of New London, case in 2005. Because there, the city of New London basically took away Kilo's property, and they said, it wasn't a Walmart, but it was something else. They said, our town will be a lot nicer if we tear down your house and put something else there. That's our public use. And the Supreme Court went along with that and said, I guess that's that's a public use, making the whole town a little bit nicer in general. The pendulum keeps swinging on that. A lot of people were up in arms about that decision. Now, interestingly, everybody was mad at the Supreme Court for ruling the way they did. Nobody was particularly concerned that the city of New London City Council had gone along with this. They didn't want to burn those people in effigy, but they wanted to burn the Supreme Court in effigy. I disagree with that Supreme Court decision, the Supreme Court, they weren't the only bad guys in there. So we have to be a little bit more vigilant in our oversight of our elected officials as well. And then, of course, the city of New London, they abandoned the project, and now it's they didn't do it anyway after they kicked poor old Kilo out of their property. But anyway, the pendulum is going to be swinging on that. So that was kind of an extreme case. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the later cases throttle back that holding just a little bit. So anyway, with that, we have now reached the conclusion of Lesson 7. We have had all kinds of your flashbacks to law school of your property professor trying to get you to say what property is, even though you knew full well before you went in there. But after law school, you were able to articulate it a little bit better about what exactly does it mean that something is property? What exactly does it mean that you own something? What does it mean to have title to a piece of property? Thank you again for listening to this part. In our final couple of sessions, we will be looking at the criminal law and criminal procedure in our remaining session. So again, if you stumbled on this program somewhere and want to know what we're talking about, visit my website, richardclem.com, where we'll see more about this and other continuing legal education programs.